The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Well, happy Science Week, everyone. I hope you're enjoying it and checking out all of the events on scienceweek.ie. The theme this year is Choose Your Future. So coming up on this week's show, we'll be looking at the future of learning with Anne Devitt from Learnovate and asking, what will schools look like in the future? Will there even be schools, or will we just ask our surroundings for the information we need to know and just get it by osmosis? We'll also be speaking to the brilliant Sean B. Carroll on chance and the extreme unlikely probability that you became you. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at @newstalkscience, or you can text us for 30 cent 53106. It's time now to look back at the week's science news, and joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Duncan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Is about bacteria in space.
Yeah, exactly, it is. So this is about a bacteria called Deinococcus radiodurans. And they did an experiment in the International Space Station, and they put these bacteria outside of the space station in the full, to get the full whack of the effects of space, and they left them there for a year. So let's not forget that there is cosmic radiation, there's UV radiation from the sun, the space is a vacuum, there's massive temperature fluctuations. So this is a really hostile environment that almost nothing should survive in. And what they found a year later is not only had these Deinococcus survived, they'd survived almost completely intact. This is researchers from the University of Vienna. And they did a lot of work.
Almost entirely intact. I mean, surely if it's not entirely intact, then it didn't really survive.
Well, do you know what? I should have said almost entirely unchanged. They are entirely intact. And so they definitely stayed intact. They definitely survived. And morphologically, so that's their shape and their outward the features, they are exactly the same. They did find that they had changed a little bit on the inside, but actually really interestingly. So one of the things they'd done is they'd upregulated a type of protein that helps to deal with stress. So it helps to remove reactive oxygen species, which are the kind of things that occur in us, in bacteria, in everyone when there's stress. So they upregulated a protein that got rid of these reactive oxygen species, and they did really, really well. And it's a really interesting idea because most people would ascribe to the idea that life on Earth began in the primordial ooze, where molecules came together and they became, you know, say probably DNA, and then that became proteins, and so on. But this potentially lends itself to the idea of panspermia, where life on Earth could potentially have been seeded from life elsewhere. Now, that life still had to come from somewhere, so, you know, let's not get too deep into that. But it's quite interesting to say that a bacteria can remain completely unscathed in space for at least a year, and who knows how long.
Presumably, these bacteria were replicating and dying as bacteria normally do.
Absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no chance that a single bacteria could survive for a year. They tend to replicate every 20 minutes, most bacteria. So there's absolutely no chance that the initial bacteria are the ones that survived. They definitely replicated. And all the evidence shows that they stayed virtually the same, except potentially became more robust.
So they evolved to be better adapted to space?
Well, not so much evolved. They would have utilized facilities that they already had to facilitate, to fight stresses. So they would have already had these things in their genes, but they would have upregulated them to make sure they survived.
Very interesting. Shane, our second story has also to do with space, and it's about a British firm planning to turn moon rock into oxygen and building materials. What's going on here?
Yeah, so it's Apollo 17 was the last time that humans set foot on the moon 48 years ago. So there's a lot of talk about us going back with missions, and NASA's Orion mission for 2024, I believe. So if we go back, we're going to have to do something better than we just getting there, because we've done that already. So there's talk of building a lunar base, a moon village, as it were, and how we're going to build that.
Would that be a moon village in space? Sorry, absolutely. That's just a fun thing to say. Go on.
So, yes, pigs in space. Talk of building this moon village. And one of the key things they'll need are materials to build it. So there's been a lot of work done in the UK between this British firm and Glasgow University on looking at how they can take moon rock and moon dust and, using electrochemistry, turn it into oxygen and other metals such as iron, silicon, and aluminium. So the it's pretty cool, actually, how they do this. And it's an experiment that would be familiar to many people from school, where you can take a chemical, you can apply electric current to it, and you can force an a chemical reaction. So in school, we would have turned water into its constituent hydrogen and oxygen. And on the moon, they're taking the moon rock and they're turning it into oxygen, which takes up about 45% of its weight, and the remaining elements, which are iron, silicon, and aluminium.
These are very useful things to have around the moon, right?
Absolutely. Oxygen in particular, because you need it for breathing, but also oxygen is rocket fuel. So you could launch return missions from the moon to Earth using this oxygen, or you could launch missions to other places like Mars. And why it is interesting, or I suppose appealing, to do that is the gravity on the moon is about a tenth of Earth's gravity. So launching things from it is much easier than it is to launch things from Earth.
You could probably jump from the moon back to Earth. I mean, I'm no scientist.
No, you can't. There's a...
I'm no scientist, but I think you could probably jump.
Oh, we're back. Well aware, Jonathan.
I chose a different path, Shane. I chose a different path. Very cool. And just out of interest, are they allowed to do that?
This is what I thought. There is an outer space treaty, and it's an international treaty, and it's similar to the Antarctic one, which is meant to govern how we use unclaimed places. But most countries tend to ignore these because they can enforce them. So I would hope that if they're going to do work on the moon, that they would do it in such a way that's incredibly respectful of the fact that, you know, this...
As we have done through civilization, Shane, we've been respectful of things that aren't ours and thoughtful about the environment and taken care to not leave any trace. Our third story, Lara, has to do with when we eat. And I find this is a really fascinating one because it debunks a couple of theories that we've heard recently.
Yeah, absolutely, Jonathan. This is interesting. So it's not published research yet. It's going to be presented at the American Heart Association meeting, which is happening this weekend. And it's based a lot on this idea of intermittent fasting. It's very much a fad at the moment. That's potentially not fair because there's a lot of evidence to show that intermittent fasting does help with things like diabetes, obesity, even cancers. There's research to show that it can help with that. The idea of intermittent fasting is to do what people generally do is eat very, very little on 2 of the 7 days in the week, or they eat everything within a 6 or 8 hour period. So in this research, in this study, what they did is they took 41 obese people with pre-diabetes or diabetes, and they gave them all a healthy diet. So for 12 weeks, they all had to eat exactly the same thing as each other, except half of them, 21 of them, had to eat everything, well, 80% of everything before 1 p.m., And the other half just got to eat at normal times, which means they ate about 50% of their calories after 5 p.m., which is what we all tend to do. We tend to have big dinners in the Western world. And what they found at the end of it, the good news is that everybody lost weight and everybody's blood pressure reduced, which is great. So I suppose they're proving that eat healthily for 12 weeks and you will do better. But they found that there was no difference between the groups. So the people who hooshed all their food in before 1 p.m., which is, you know, what evidence suggests would be the people who did really, really well, they did no better than the people who spread their meals out and even ate, you know, reasonably big meals after 5 p.m. So I suppose it sort of slightly flies in the face of the idea of intermittent fasting for increased weight loss or for blood pressure reduction. Now, they didn't really look at the diabetes, so they are going to go back and research that and see if it made any difference for that, which would be very interesting. But overall, it's saying that restricting the feeding in these particular group of women before 1 p.m. made no difference.
If you can hear some noise in the background, Lara is actually on her break at the hospital. So thank you so much for being so dedicated to
I'm
the program,
so sorry,
Lara.
I'm standing in a corridor.
Listen,
I hope it's not
go,
too loud.
Go help the needy, and thanks very much. Shane, our final story has to do with a nice little bit of innovation that is sort of inspired by camels.
Yeah, so this is another example of biomimicry, where we look for things that happen in the natural world, and then we try to mimic them with materials. So camels stay cool using two lines of protection. The first one is they sweat like us. So by doing that, they release water from glands, and that water is heated up by the warm skin and it evaporates. And when it evaporates, heat from the skin is transferred to the water, and it evaporates, leaving the skin behind a little bit cooler. That's how we cool down as well. Hmm. The extra layer that the camels have is this layer of fur, and it provides an insulating shield around them to stop the heat getting in from the sun to warm up the skin in the first place.
Which is kind of funny, because you'd imagine fur would actually make you much hotter.
Well, it's like a thermos. If you have something cold in it, it'll stay cold. If you have something warm in it, it'll stay warm. It's
Indeed.
Just preventing the transfer of heat, or I suppose the equilibrium of being reached between the two things. So scientists in MIT have replicated this using two materials. So they've created a bilayer. So it's like one material on top of the other, mimicking the camel. So they're using a hydrogel as the chemical that mimics the sweating action. So this is able to lose heat very efficiently without a power source. And the other material they're using then is an aerogel, and that mimics the insulation. So they put one on top of the other, and now you have this fantastic material that can keep things cold and cool them down as well. So what do you think this could be used for? Well, food and medicine and stuff like that, right?
But the claims of how well it works are pretty extraordinary, right?
Oh, absolutely. So they've been able to show in kind of ideal lab conditions that you can cool something down by 7 degrees relative to its surroundings, which is incredible considering there's no power source here. And then it can stay cold for 5 times longer than like best in market at the moment.
It's unbelievable. Just, like you can imagine, like for me, obviously keeping beer cold at a festival, God knows when we get to festivals again, but keeping beer cold at a festival, or keeping food unspoiling when you're out all day at a picnic or something, that's amazing.
Yes, and it also is a window into your lifestyle there.
It is indeed. Picnics and festivals, all the winter things. And so when are we likely to see this be commercialized, Shane?
Well, MIT would be one of the best places in the world to take technology like this and turn it into products. So it's also incredibly simple in its design. It doesn't have any sophisticated nanomaterials or anything like that in there. So I reckon this is the sort of thing that could go to market pretty quickly. And by pretty quickly, probably within about 5 years.
Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan on our break. Thank you very much for joining us. All right, coming up, what will the future of learning look like? Yes, you're listening to Future Proof, and it is Science Week. Loads and loads and loads of events have been happening up and down the country, and there's still more to go. Check out scienceweek.ie for more information, or use the hashtag ScienceWeek. If you look that up, you'll see lots of things that are happening, including lots of events I was involved with, Chagask and St. Angela's in NUI Galway, and lots of other things. So thanks very much for those people who had me along. But the theme for Science Week this year was Choose Your Future. And I thought it would be a great idea to talk about the future of education, because it's a big question at the moment, both in the near term, but also in the long term. What are we going to do about learning in the future with the number of changes that are happening, not just the pandemic, but also technologies that are evolving and the skills that are now required in the age of AI and the internet? Well, here to help us navigate is Dr. Anne Devitt. She is the Academic Director of Learnovate. Anne, you're very welcome to the program. Let's talk a little bit about learning as it is at the moment, because it seems to me it hasn't changed a huge amount how we teach both children and adults, despite all of this internet and the technologies that are around us.
I suppose this year has seen us absolutely transform what's happening in education. The, you know, what might normally have taken 10 years has happened, or maybe 5 years has happened in the space of 6 months. But I think the classrooms, if you like, of today in primary and secondary and third level, they haven't been the same. You know, it's still, people talk about the industrial model of us churning infants through school until they pop out the other end as good workers. Education hasn't really been like that for a long time. We still have the same buildings, in some cases exactly the same buildings. But what's going on inside the classrooms today is a lot more active, a lot more driven by the learners, you know, more learner-centered and so on, than it might have been before. But I suppose what had not changed, or where we had stayed quite still, was technology was becoming integrated in classrooms, but maybe not as integrated or as useful as it might be. And so the last 6 months have seen a huge change in that. But still, we've, you know, there's still a long way to go. I think what's happened in recent times is that essentially educators who might have maybe not seen the value, or maybe didn't have the space to engage with where technology might help them in their, you know, in teaching and learning, that they've had to do that. And so the kind of skills of educators has just exploded in the last 6 months. And that has a huge impact on classrooms.
I'm surprised to say that the learning culture has changed quite a bit, because my understanding was Leaving Cert was still very much learn this by rote, dump it out on a particular day and get your marks. Is that has that been radically changed since I went to school and did my Leaving Cert, what, 30 or 25 years ago?
Yeah, Jonathan, I have to agree with you there. The Leaving Cert has not changed. It needs to, and it's in the process of change. So there's a senior cycle review underway from the NCCA, which is looking to push things forward. But it's actually, as a population, we just have to release our complete and utter obsession with exams. It's our own fault. So in when the junior cycle review happened, and there has been a lot of change due to the junior cycle review in classrooms, but not enough, because there wasn't enough of a release in how it is that we plan to assess that program of learning. Yeah. And we saw the issue this year, you know, after the Leaving Cert students at the end of 2 years of learning, we had no reliable evidence of what they had learned. We had to wait to the exams. And that's why we had this whole hoo-ha about, you know, a massive issue around what we were going to do in the absence of a Leaving Cert and in the absence of those CAO points.
Yeah, and that's clearly a failure
unacceptable,
of the system.
Yeah.
So let's talk then a little bit about the future. There are so many technologies that are coming to maturity that could be utilized in schools. But of course, cost and other things are an issue. But realistically, if we try and project even 15 years into the future, what do we see learning look like when it comes to things like virtual reality, augmented reality, virtual classrooms, experiential learning through technology? Can you give me a snapshot of some of the ideas that are being tossed around at the moment?
Sure. Well, I've been having wonderful conversations over the last couple of weeks with people in industry and researchers in Trinity around what this future might look like. So imagine a class of 8-year-olds heading out into the woods with their class to discover the local environment and nature. And they're going to do all the lovely things that children have been doing forever, you know, playing with leaves and drawing in mud and all the rest. And their teachers probably organize some lovely hands-on activities that will make them engage with the physical experience of being outside. So they might be making journey sticks and doing bark rubbings and creating bivouacs and all the rest in this outside environment. Now, imagine a future that's actually not too far away at all. So the technology is there, but probably what's not there is the availability of the hardware and so on. But in this future, as a child approaches a tree, maybe they can reach out to that tree and see an image of what the inside of the tree looks like. Maybe they can zoom in and look at the cellular structure of that tree. Maybe they can see or hear what's happening inside the tree as they stand and look at it. So they might have a visual of the photosynthesis process where, you know, energy, where the tree is making energy from light and releasing oxygen and so on, or drawing water up from the soil. So this kind of augmented reality is available, certainly, now. And I suppose oftentimes it's attached, if you like, the augmented reality options are attached to, you know, physical objects in the world. And all it takes, I suppose, is for us to be able to map the world around us, where the technology becomes available that a visual representation of a tree might draw down the metadata for that tree and make that available within a learning environment. And so what that requires at the moment is headsets like the HoloLens from, I think that's Microsoft.
Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, so we're already in the second generation of those kinds of, that kind of hardware. And so that those options and those possibilities become more possible.
For listeners who may not be familiar, you can Google Microsoft HoloLens demonstration. Some of the demonstrations are obviously a little bit more advanced than the technology that's currently commercially available. But the idea is that you can paint a projection onto surfaces that are mapped in real time that actually looks like something has come to life. You can paint onto reality with information, images, 3D sort of films and so on. And the potential for that technology is really enormous, Anne, because if we're trying to imagine, you know, what happened in the trenches in World War II, you know, looking left and right and seeing, instead of your classmates sitting on their chairs, seeing them in the trenches themselves, certainly that's a way of giving someone that really special feeling.
Yeah, so I had a wonderful conversation with Gareth Young, who's one of the researchers in the vSense group, Alyosha Smolik's vSense group in Trinity, earlier this week. And we were talking about cross reality, which is that kind of, I guess it's a bi-directional movement where you bring the digital into the real world. So like augmented reality, you are in the real world and you can feel and see the real world, but you bring some additional reality from the digital space into the real world with you and experience that. So as you said, looking at the trenches or out in the woods, maybe you can see what was happening in that space in the past or might happen in the future. And then you have the opposite direction where you bring the physical into the digital space. So in that case, you might be out in the world, you might be taking photos of your local environment and mapping that and bringing that then into a virtual space that you can share with others. So Gareth was telling me about a model he has of parts of Clontarf that people can walk into in a virtual space and walk around and learn a little bit about that physical reality, but in a digital world. And so the options there are, you know, they're available and they're available now and they're close. But I suppose like any technology, when it comes to adoption of that and especially adoption of that in education, so we've got cost, certainly, you know, we've got hardware issues, and then you have, you know, how is it contributing enough to the learning for it to be of use? So we can't be led by the technology, we have to be led by the learning, but certainly the opportunities there around augmented reality or around virtual reality they're so exciting. You know, imagine being inside a volcano, you're inside your classroom, but through virtual reality, you get to experience, you know, what the inside of a volcano looks like. Maybe not so much what it feels like, but
I'm imagining, you know, Pompeii. I've never been, but I've seen photographs, obviously, and it looks like this extraordinary place where you can see, you know, history already made. But imagine being there and being able to see a representation of that lava coming from Mount Vesuvius. I mean, and actually creating what's there, and then the movie finishes with the reality of today. There's so many opportunities if that technology is employed. I think you're right that the cost is probably going to keep it from being something that's in every school for a while, but we are getting to these devices being cheaper and cheaper. I wanted to move on to talking about what we learn, because in the future, will we still need to know facts? I mean, as it is, Google's pretty good at getting sort of agreed nuggets of information for me. You know, if I ask it to do a mathematical sum, if I ask it the capital of something. And of course, with increased development, we're going to have better conversational AI where they will understand more context. In 15 or 20 years, will we need to know facts, or will that information be pointless in our brains?
Well, I suppose, again, we're already there in a lot of ways, Jonathan. You know, the the most recent curriculum development that's happening right now in Ireland is around the primary language curriculum. And it's not to say the facts are not there, but the emphasis is on the skills development of the children. So, you know, we're very aware that, you know, technology and just the world, the range of resources we have around us make that level of recall of facts just redundant most of the time. And the Leaving Cert just goes to demonstrate how completely not valuable it is. So the, you know, the Leaving Cert is very much, a lot of it is very focused around recall. And I've done research in that area myself with a PhD student, Denise Burns, looking at what are the demands, for example, of exams, of Leaving Cert exams. And oftentimes you are just being asked to remember stuff, and that it doesn't have, you know, it has limited value. Whereas in the new primary language or primary curriculum and the junior cycle and the senior cycle review, they're looking at this, the integrated set of key skills that we should be developing through through our learning. And these things are not fact-based. They're very much about what it is that we need in order to survive in the world, in order to be active citizens, and in order to, you know, to be creative and flexible in our...
And solve problems. I mean...
problem solving is number one in there as a key skill across the curriculum.
Problem solving, which I didn't do much of when on my Leaving Cert, communication skills, collaboration skills, creativity, those things that were very much the side of the main drive of education when I was a student now seem to be the most important thing.
Yeah, very, very much so. And I mean, just to, you know, we were saying a little bit before about what has changed and what hasn't changed. Those skills are in there and they're embedded, and people have been working, you know, teachers have been working to make sure that those are developed. There's been some beautiful kind of move in the direction of teachers as facilitators of learning and developing those skill sets across the curriculum and all of that. But our problem in Ireland and elsewhere is always that if you don't assess that, if you don't assess the skill set that you want to develop, people are going to emphasize those elements that you are assessing. And that's what happens in our Leaving Cert now. You assess the facts, that's what you get.
Let's talk a bit about the technology, because one of the dangers and limitations of inverted commas facts is that once you get beyond mathematics, there are two sides to every story. We look at history, we look at, you know, the current debate around science, pandemic, truth and lies. If we imagine that in the future we will get our facts from other sources, we won't need to remember them ourselves, isn't there a real danger in education that those who have the best technology get to shape what the reality looks like, or is that already happening as well?
Well, we with social media and, you know, those that's a kind of expansion in our use of digital over the last 10 years, I suppose, you know, particularly since we have the smartphones, we have done an incredibly poor job as a planet, as a species, of managing that transition. So that now, you know, we've essentially given away all of the, we've given our attention away to companies who can then manage that. And so within our learning environments, so it in formal education and informal education, we have to maintain a focus on criticality, on that ability to make judgments. So where we're talking about, you know, recall of facts being the kind of lowest level of learning, if you like, that top level of learning, that higher order skills, you know, if we're talking about Bloom's taxonomy, the top level is judgment. It's how to evaluate, you know, the quality of information that we're getting, the sources of information that we're getting. And it's not, you don't have to be an adult to do this. You can be doing this from the very start of primary school, from early years, where you're looking at, you know, where are you getting this information and what does it mean?
Worry that the children today who are asking the basic questions of Google and getting 100% adult agreed correct answers may not realize that once you get beyond the real basic questions, there's a lot more up for debate. And you know, you then wonder, what is the education policy of Google when it comes to giving out information through Google Assistant? Or what's Apple's take on evolution when it comes to getting information from Siri, and it becomes a little worrying. I want to finish up actually and just talking about one more thing, and that is the potential of robots taking over the jobs of humans. Do we still see a future for human teachers? Is there research to show that people still want to have that human connection, or could we replace teachers with very interesting videos and 3D exhibits, but all student led?
So I think what might be a better way to phrase that might be, what do we need teachers for? So one thing is that the COVID experience demonstrated to us that we definitely need communication and collaboration for learning. You know, learning on your own is too hard and it's lonely and not enjoyable. So we definitely need people in that endeavor. And we do need, to some degree, more knowledgeable others. You know, we need people who know something more. So that could be a peer or it could be a teacher. But even in environments, so like School 42 in France, which is a totally peer-led, you know, it's kind of a peer-led project-based environment for coding. But in there, they do have a pedagogical team that designs the projects and designs the learning experience.
So there's not actually a teacher, but there is someone who pulls the strings in some respect.
Yeah, so there's nobody in a room telling you what to do. And I think for, you know, even that discussion around, you know, you don't need facts anymore. We don't need somebody to tell us the facts. We don't need that anymore, the lecturing environment. But what teaching essentially is about is structuring the experience so that people can learn from it. And that's where, you know, whether they're directly beside you in the classroom or whether they're doing that in the background in some online context, that kind of intentional design of an activity or an experience that is going to harness your motivation, get you in the mood, give you the, you know, get you going towards learning goals and scaffold you up to that. So allow you to take the smaller steps that get you to the bigger steps. All of that is going to remain necessary, perhaps in a different way.
Well, Anne Devitt, Academic Director of LearnDevate, thanks very much and happy Science Week.
Thanks a million, Jonathan.
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Now, we put a lot of stock into the likelihood of certain things happening depending on the circumstances. Chance can have a huge impact on our future actions, be it a game of cards or putting everything on red. But what about the bigger events in our lives? What about our lives full stop? What are the chances of us being born as us? Well, the figures are pretty astounding. Sean B. Carroll is a Baylor Simon Professor and Endowed Chair of Biology at the University of Maryland, and is the author of a new book called A Series of Fortunate Events, Chance and the Making of the Planet, Life and You. He joins me now. Sean, you're very welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jonathan. Great to be here.
What is the starting point for this book? Why did you want to write a book about chance?
Because I think it's a huge idea that's really underappreciated. We have that, as you brought up in the intro, in our everyday lives. You know, we love games of chance. But when it comes to our biological lives, all the things that happened before we got here as our individual lives and the things that will happen during our life, we're not so enthusiastic about chance. We wish things were a little more under our control and a little more favorable. But there's a lot of randomness in the living world.
Yeah, you start off talking about this happenstance impact that happened in the Yucatan Peninsula that sort of changed everything specifically for us. And I had no idea how specific that impact had to be for everything to change and for mammals essentially to start to thrive.
Right. So 66 million years ago, a 6 mile wide space rock entered the atmosphere about 50,000 miles per hour, slammed into the Yucatan Peninsula. Now, most people have heard that story. They understand that that was the trigger to the end of the dinosaurs, a trigger to mass extinction, but probably don't appreciate that, you know, with the Earth turning at 1,000 miles an hour, had that rock, which was probably circulating the solar system for perhaps a few billion years, had it entered 30 minutes sooner or 30 minutes later, it would have hit somewhere else and probably a place that did not have the same kinds of rocks as the Yucatan, which was important for the toxic stew that brought about the mass extinction. So just 30 minutes one way or another, and we're not having this conversation, very likely dinosaurs are still on the globe. Mammals are a insignificant part of the living world, and no two-legged humans whatsoever. So I started the story there because I thought that, you know, while that's a distant event, everybody's heard of it. And with that specificity, I can say, look, without some of these distant events, the world as we know it would not exist.
I hadn't ever thought that the geology of the Yucatan Peninsula was important. I thought this rock hit, wherever it hit, it was going to cause mass destruction. And while it certainly would have had a big impact on life, you're arguing that actually the rocks that are thrown up were specifically sort of killer the blow for dinosaurs.
A lot of sulfur, a lot of carbonate. And so that made a toxic stew, the vapor plume that was blasted into the air and probably circulated for at least a decade, maybe three. With that high sulfur content, that reflected the sunlight back, that contributed to the darkening of the globe. The darkening of the globe meant we shut down photosynthesis, plants no longer making their food. And the carbonates also contributed to these long-lasting conditions. In addition, in the short term, there were wildfires and all sorts of other things that were not good. But nonetheless, had it hit in the ocean, it's most likely we would not have had as large a magnitude. Geologists estimate that only 1% to maybe 13% of the surface of the Earth contains the right kind of rocks that, if hit, could create that kind of toxic plume.
You go on to talk about the Ice Age and how ice ages are very much dependent on chance too. So the chance of us being hit in a 1 hour window of 66 million years is just the first stepping point to us being born. And there are many more enormous numbers in our way.
Yeah. So the last 2 million years on Earth have been a really weird time climatically. It's the first ice age in 300 million years. And the reason for that ice age, if you trace the dominoes back, it's that 140 million years ago, a little piece of a giant supercontinent, one of those little pieces that broke off, which we would know as the Indian subcontinent, was small and moved faster than the other plates moving across the surface of the Earth. And it slammed into Asia about 40 million years ago and built the Himalaya. And that event triggered cooling across the globe. And eventually tipping us into the ice ages. And you'd say, well, okay, that's cool. Oh, sorry, that's terrible. I did unintentional pun. But the point about the ice ages, why it's important to humans, is that the ice ages represents these really extreme cycles of climate, cold, warm in the northern hemisphere, but wet, dry in Africa. And our human ancestors, appear to have been, much better equipped to adapt to this by using tools and forging their own habitat, fire, et cetera. And this is the period where brain evolution underwent its most rapid expansion, the 2 million years of the ice age. So paleoanthropologists have thought for quite a while that the ice ages are one of the driving forces towards, big brained hominids like ourselves. And that, of course, trace it back to the Indian subcontinent hitting the Himalaya, trace it back to the breakup of continents 140 million years ago. So we're starting to put some specificity here on the dominoes that have to fall for us to be here.
Some people might argue that there is an inevitability about these things, or that if that one thing didn't happen, something else would have happened. But you talk about the crazy numbers that are involved in creating a single person. And I'm sure people know we have lots of men have lots of sperm, and there's a big fight to get to that egg. But I don't think people fully realize the unlikelihood of you being you.
Yeah, we could do a pop quiz with listeners today. So how many genetically unique children could any couple have? Your mom and dad, or if you're married and have a partner, How many children might you be able to have genetically distinct? And to get to that number, you have to know that you contribute 23 chromosomes in a sperm, 23 chromosomes in an egg. So you might think, okay, 23 plus 23, what is that, 46? I don't know, 90? No, the answer is 70 trillion. 70 trillion genetically distinct babies.
I'm surprised it's that that small, because if you look at the sequence of DNA, you know, you got 3 billion pairs of letters. If you look at a mutation in each of those, surely would have a distinct boy or girl.
Jonathan, you're 100% right. So I only did the basic math of just the sorting of chromosomes that mom and dad have. On top of that, random mutations happen. That's what you're referring to, which actually drives that number way beyond 70 trillion. So you have sort of 70 trillion distinct chromosomal combinations, but random mutations essentially drive that number to almost anything you want, because, as you said, we're going to pick up 20 or 30 mutations in the 3 billion base pairs of DNA that were not present in mom or dad each time, and those are going to be spread all over the place. So it's a huge number of combinations. But probably if you just sort of think about, I think once you get to 70 trillion, it just sounds exhausting as it is.
Yeah. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe. So that sort of mad number of potential variations obviously ends up cementing itself in every human being as one mixture of that DNA from mom and dad. Yeah. But the point to that is what? Because there would be some version, and of course, if the person is born, then there must have been some mix of DNA. So why does it matter that the exact DNA mix for you is so unique?
Well, I think it's fun to contemplate. Just imagine that, you know, our uniqueness, unless you're identical twins, you know, no two humans born on this planet will ever be identical, ever be the same. No two fertilized eggs will ever be the same. That the way the sort of genetic recipe is mixed up, that it generates all this uniqueness, all this diversity. And when we think about ourselves that way, we realize that the sort of the shuffling of chromosomes and the accumulation of mutations, then you look around the rest of the living world and you realize that everything you're looking at is a product of chance, that the source of all diversity, all human diversity, is a matter of chance. Well, all biological diversity is a matter of chance. So it's kind of opens the, I particularly talk about it in the book because I think it helps people sort of wrap their heads around just how much we live in a chance-driven world.
Yeah. And in the book, you talk about mutations and how mutations are important, because people know that the copying of a genome that happens at the very earliest stages of what will become life is near perfect. It's really, really incredibly nearly perfect, but it can't be perfect, because if it's perfect, you wouldn't have evolution, right?
You'd have no change at all. So it's probably in a little sort of Goldilocks zone, where if it was more imperfect, we'd have too much of a burden of mutations and we'd have too much sort of really disease and disability. But that small amount of mutation gives us, you know, really the glorious diversity that we enjoy both as a species and as in just one species among millions.
I think that's such a lovely idea of it being broken to the point of perfection. I think that's a lovely way to think about DNA. So at the end of your book, do you multiply all the numbers together to come with one final number of how unlikely it is that Jonathan McCray is Jonathan McCray?
Well, no, I don't. I'll let you
should have. You should have done that. You should have done that.
You want to know, maybe for your next negotiation, you want to know just how unique you are.
Yeah. Nobody could do the show like me, says Sean B. Carroll.
Well, that goes without saying. That needs no scientific foundation. I think I just want to, I build a picture that for people, you know, because we're shaking off, you know, centuries, if not millennia, of thinking that we're here by design. And, you know, so there's a profound side of chance that rattles a lot of our philosophical foundations. And so by giving it some specificity in this book, I hope both for people to have some awe and wonder and astonishment that they are here, that we're all here, that there can be so much beauty and order in a chance-run, you know, chance-driven system. But also it means that some of our, I think maybe some of the crutches we might lean on to think that, you know, things are not as random as we feared, that we may have to dispense with those crutches, that there's a lot of randomness in the world. And we're living through one the pandemic we're living through is, you know, randomly mutating viruses are all over the place in the animal kingdom. And one of them found a way to get into a human, and we've all been locked down for 9 months, right? And 50 million people infected, and enormous number of people dead, and it's a completely chance event. So if you need a little underscoring of, you know, chance plays a role every day. I didn't know this pandemic was coming when I started the book, but I certainly recognized it as yet another one of these, you know, chance-driven phenomena that can have a huge impact on biology.
And of course, there's a whole bunch of chance that happens in our lives. We did a show on this not so long ago. You'll get it in the podcast, the Future Proof podcast extra this week. We did a show on chance to talk about all the likelihood of things happening. And one thing that we rarely remark upon, we remark upon the unusual things, the things that you say, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. And yet every day you turn left instead of right and you don't get knocked down, or, you know, you go to the toilet in the airport and you miss bumping into your long lost best friend and end up leaving your husband or wife for that person. We don't, you know, there's that sliding doors thing that we don't even mention, because mathematically, of course, it must be happening. But because we don't see it, because that reality didn't cement itself in the way that Schrodinger kind of alluded to, that we don't think about the world as being one freaky improbability.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's fun to play the what if games. What if this went this way? What if it went that way? You know, it's unsettling, you know, fun on the one hand, but I understand it can be very unsettling, to feel that even the things that we treasure the most, you know, are the product of, you know, a series of fortunate events. Maybe that's a path to gratitude. Maybe that's a path to appreciation that, we are fortunate to be here having this conversation. We are here to be fortunate with, you know, beautiful families and living in this, you know, awesome world. Even if there's so much randomness in it.
It seems to me that this is sort of a humanist text, right? But I know American authors really don't like wading into that that world of saying, look, religion is a construct, and that we are essentially elements of chance. You sort of alluded to that, but I imagine, like many authors, when we get to this area, from America, you'd like to distance yourself from saying that this is a proof that religion is not really very sensical.
Well, I deal with this in the last chapter, the afterword, in fact. Fair assessment, because the climate is different in the States than say in Ireland or the UK. But here we go. In the last chapter, I take this on because it does have important philosophical implications, but I do it with some special guests. And what happened over the years, I guess, that I've been thinking about chance is I started to recognize that the one group of people other than scientists that think the world is driven by blind chance is a whole bunch of comedians and humorists. From authors, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and Mark Twain, to present day comedians like Ricky Gervais and Seth MacFarlane and Eddie Izzard and Eric Idle. I actually reached out to some. I interviewed Eric Idle for the book and asked, you know, why do you talk about these things? How do you roll them into your act? And I think it's only fair to the listener that I don't tell you the punchline of that conversation. You can read about it in the conversation. But nonetheless, it was to me very enlightening to understand why these great comedians have taken on that question of, well, what's it all mean? And there's some really poignant things that folks like Ricky Gervais have to say about, well, okay, if it's a chance-driven world, how do we live our lives? And I think that's probably the second part of the conversation, that when you start come to the sort of cliff of, well, what's this mean for religion? Is, gee, if it's all chance, does it mean there's no point? Does it mean there's no, you know, no morals or something like that? No. It just means that if you appreciate that this is the one life you have, and we're lucky to have it, it actually, I think, engenders empathy towards other people, compassion for those who are less fortunate, a sense of urgency about how we live our lives today. It can have very positive motivating factors. And, I think there's, you know, if you overcome that skittishness or some of the fears of confronting this, I think there's a nice worldview waiting for you on the other side.
I remember Professor Brian Cox saying that if it turns out that there is no God and we are actually just a complete fluke, a random mutation that doesn't exist on any other planet anywhere else, that it behooves us to protect this extraordinarily special twist of fate that is life on the planet. And I thought it was a rather elegant way of putting it. Really interesting book. It's a nice short read and explores some big ideas. Sean B. Carroll, author of A Series of Fortunate Events. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Jonathan.
It is true, though, speaking to American scientists, they just don't like talking about religion. They don't like wearing their atheism or their humanism on their sleeve. And it's because it's so polarizing in the States that you're just opening a door to trouble, which is very worrying that you can't just be an open atheist and, I suppose, want to be successful in America. Aidan McKelvey, producer, joins us now. What do you make of that, Aidan? That it's kind of complicated in America to say, you know, there's no such thing as God, that we are just here through chance.
Yeah, well, I've always found it very strange that the American president always has to mention God, and you know, it's in God we trust.
God bless
and
us.
And I mean,
God bless America.
Exactly, and they have in their constitution, like, which they always go on about, like it's the greatest thing that ever happened to the country. They have it enshrined at the state, and the state is like secular.
Yeah.
And yet they persist with this.
In God, and even Barack Obama, which I just assume is an atheist, because he certainly didn't spend a lot of time talking about God.
No.
And you think if you're at that highest power and you were a believer, you'd mention them all the time. You think, right? But it didn't feature at all for him, I don't think.
Well, Trump is the most egregious one. Like, I mean, if there's any more of an example of somebody who's not a believer in the lessons of Jesus Christ, whether or not you believe he existed, there are some fine lessons in there. And he still had the audacity to make it out like he was religious. Like, yeah. I don't know. It's insane.
I made the argument that I would say while Ireland is seen as a religious country, you'd be hard-pressed to sit someone down, tie them to a chair and say, okay, you have to tell me the truth. Do you believe in a magic person in the sky? I think now that's me being maybe just a bit facetious, but that's, you know, that's essentially the tenet of what is supposedly the most prominent religion in our country, the idea that there is a higher power, a God that is all-knowing and all-present, and that also that we meet this God in upon our death. And I think if you sat down and said, be 100% honest, I'd say you'd struggle to find someone who said, that's exactly what I believe. I think maybe it's just the secular world I live in. But when you move to the States, you know, it's one in every three. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'd say you'd get a lot in Ireland. You'd get a lot of agnostic people or people who vaguely believe in some sort of kind of supernatural being or like omnipotent being, which, as I said before, in a discussion with your brother, actually, I think it's fair enough, but I don't think you'd get that many people who'd subscribe to, or very few at all, subscribe to the Bible.
And the literal, the real, literal interpretation. Like word for word. Yeah. You're absolutely right. If we're talking about, do people believe that there's more than just us and that there is something spiritual going on that we are not aware of, I'd say that's probably a much bigger figure. But the quite literalism of some Americans, at least vocally, to me is it is remarkable, and it just goes to show you know that you speaking out and speaking your mind as an author or someone in the public eye, you know, famously Neil deGrasse Tyson doesn't like to wade in here. It's an interesting culture to speak to people about that. Right, it's time to look at our texts and tweets from last week, as we do at this point in the podcast. And we were talking about brain chemistry and the chemicals that drive you with Ginny Smith. Someone says, isn't there a connection between gum disease and some forms of dementia due to some chemicals? I think there is a bacteria. You're right that there is some link to gum disease and dementia, and I think it's to do with the bacteria. That's my best guess. I should have probably Googled this to sound smart beforehand, but I haven't done that. Have you, Aidan?
I'm afraid I have not.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll move on. I'll secretly do that while we talk about the next one, which is about zombies. You might remember we talked about zombie movies and how they may tell us about how humans behave in a pandemic. It wasn't the best scientific item, but it was fun to talk about zombies for a while. Bob says, best zombie book, World War Z, which is actually very good. The movie was actually not bad either, Brad Pitt, but the book is supposed to be fantastic. It's an anthology of interviews from the zombie war, so a totally different way of doing that classic zombie genre. Train to Busan is the best zombie movie. I haven't seen it, actually. It's the one I keep on when I'm like, oh, there's one I'm supposed to see, but I can't remember, and I end up watching Night of the Living Dead again, or Dawn of the Dead.
Called you best, for a fan, like, to not have seen the best one is a sin.
I know. It's just it's a South Korean zombie film, I think, and I do you know what? I probably have seen. I just can't remember it. And then best zombie tune was Zombie by Fela Kuti, a satirical but incredibly funky swipe at conformity and the Nigerian military.
Yes,
I must check out. You know that one?
Yes. I know it very well. And actually, whoever sent that, I'm sure they must have listened to the podcast, because unbeknownst to you, I shoehorned in that song to the outro of the live show. It's one of my favorites. And I'm delighted that somebody picked that over Zombie by Kremlin, which is a fine tune and all, but this is top notch.
He sounds a little bit like an African Gil Scott Heron in there. Is that sort of the vibe?
I'm not. Well, you've got me unaware.
B-movie. It sounds a lot like B-movie, that song. Also a very funky tune that goes on forever, which is why I was reminded of it. All right, well, that's one hell of a tangent. Good luck understanding how on earth you got here listening to a science podcast. But that's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer, and the rest of the production team. They were Garrett Mulhall, Simon Keane, and Steve Daunt. Steve McClune was on sound. That's it from us for this week. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed, where we'll replay that that episode we did on Chance, which people liked. I think people liked it. You can listen back to that wherever you find your podcast. Just search for Future Proof, or of course you can find it in the News Talk app. We'll be back with more Future Proof Normal or Future Proof Grand next Saturday. We should have another. We need to rebrand just Future Proof Plain.
You're ruining the branding here. You're confusing everyone.
Well, we got Future Proof Extra, Future Proof Gold. What's normal Future Proof? It doesn't sound as good as Future Proof Gold. It sounds like, you know, it's like sort of average gruel, you know, compared
Future
to the
Proof Supreme.
Je ne sais quoi of Future Proof Gold.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it is top notch stuff, this main podcast.
Oh, Jesus. All right, you know what? I'm getting out of here. See you later. Bye.
Bye.